Victory is never inevitable, but justice always is.
I would much rather have somebody who drank too much taking care of my child than I had somebody whose lifestyle is questionable.
It's like a nightmare that will not stop.
We have to understand that this is a war, and if we don't engage in this war, we will lose this war.
The church is changing, and that is beautiful.
Sometimes a virus can linger in there and affect your balance or cause a ringing sound.
A virus?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Appealing winds advance U.S. marriage equality, Christian conniptions and kudos conflict over LGBT rights, and tests the movie yields positive results. All that and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending June 28, 2014. The inexorable U.S. March to Marriage Equality took another giant step forward this week. For the first time since last June's Supreme Court Windsor versus the United States ruling overturned a key provision of a law that barred the federal government from recognizing legally married lesbian and gay couples, a U.S. appeals court has affirmed their civil right to marry. Two members of a three-judge panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit agreed on June 25th with a lower district court ruling that the marriage ban in Utah violates the U.S. Constitution's guarantees of equal protection and due process. The case Kitchen v. Herbert had led to more than 1,000 same-gender couples getting married in December and January after that lower court ruling and before a U.S. Supreme Court order stopped them. Those marriages remain in legal limbo, however, because the three-judge panel immediately stayed this week's ruling pending appeal. Amidst the celebrations by equality advocates, the titular plaintiff, Derek Kitchen, told Denver TV station KUSA that
victory is never inevitable, but justice always is. And I think that we do have the right side of history to back us up.
A spokeswoman for Utah's Republican Attorney General, Sean Reyes, said his office was still deciding whether to ask the entire 10th Circuit to review the ruling or to appeal directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. Attorney Peggy Tomsic, who successfully argued on behalf of the three Utah couples, called the ruling a victory not only for those courageous couples, but for our entire state and every state within the 10th Circuit. In addition to Utah, that Denver-based appeals court also hears cases from Colorado, Kansas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Wyoming.
Within hours of the Utah decision, the Boulder County, Colorado clerk and recorder announced that she would issue marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples because her state's civil marriage ban would also be voided if the 10th Circuit decision stands. Hillary Hall told reporters that her office would continue to issue the licenses unless and until a court order stops her.
The opinion in the 10th Circuit court was clear that it's unconstitutional to deny the right of marriage to these people. Our prohibition has denied this right for far too long.
State Senator Jesse Ulibarri, a Democrat who represents Commerce City, was among those to defiantly marry, tying the knot with his long-term partner, Luis Trujillo. As of June 26th, more than 30 same-gender couples had married in Boulder, and more were expected by the end of the day on Friday, the 27th. The state's Republican Attorney General, John Southers, insisted, however, that those marriages would not be valid. Until the Supreme Court decides, we do not have same-sex marriage in Colorado, he said. We're looking at a variety of options, and that's all I'm going to say about it. And even the lawyer challenging Colorado's marriage ban in a separate case agrees that Hall's actions aren't legal because the 10th Circuit ruling is on hold pending appeal. So Utah's ban and Colorado's ban are still in place.
Four same-gender couples were married in the office of St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay on June 25th in defiance of Missouri's civil marriage ban. All of us standing here are doing this to force the issue, he said, and to get the law settled for everyone who wants to get married in the state of Missouri. Attorney General Chris Koster, who left the Republican Party for the Democrats in 2007 and is expected to run for governor in 2016, said he personally supports marriage equality, but that it was his duty to seek a temporary restraining order to stop further marriages. St. Louis Circuit Judge Rex Burleson denied his request after city officials agreed not to issue any more licenses to lesbian and gay couples without notifying the Attorney General's office and the court. The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit in February demanding that Missouri recognize the civil marriages of same-gender couples legally performed in other states.
The Chicago-based 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has issued the stay requested by Indiana's Republican Attorney General Gregory Zoeller of a federal court ruling that declared that state's ban on civil marriage for same-gender couples unconstitutional. U.S. District Court Judge Richard L. Young's June 25th ruling didn't include a stay, so same-gender couples started lining up for marriage licenses soon after it was announced. Clerks in some counties began issuing marriage licenses, while others demurred. Hundreds of gay and lesbian couples reportedly exchanged vows across Indiana before the federal appeals court issued the stay late in the day on June 27th. Like the legally wed couples fighting for civil marriage rights in Utah and in a growing number of other states, the unions of the Indiana couples will be in legal limbo until the issue is finally resolved by the courts.
Mexico's Supreme Court approved the civil marriage of a gay couple in the state of Baja California on June 25th. Victor Manuel Aguirre and Fernando Urias Amparo were denied a marriage license at Mexicali City Hall a year ago. After a federal court sided with the couple, the Baja California state legislature appealed the ruling to Mexico's Supreme Court. But under the country's legal system, the high court's ruling applies only to Aguirre and Amparo. Other same-gender couples that want to legally marry and are denied licenses will need to file their own lawsuits. The Mexican Supreme Court has issued similar marriage rights rulings for specific couples in several other states. Under the nation's legal system, however, five cases need to be won in a state before the nation's high court could issue a blanket marriage equality ruling, and it would still only apply to same-gender couples in that individual state.
In other news, a huge majority of people in the U.S. apparently believe that gays and lesbians are already protected from employment discrimination. An astonishing 69% of the respondents in a new YouGov Huffington Post survey believed it was illegal under federal law to fire someone based simply on sexual orientation. 18% were unsure, and only 13% of those surveyed correctly said that no such federal law exists. The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, would add LGBT people to the country's laws that already protect people in the workplace based on race, gender, and a host of other immutable characteristics. Different versions of ENDA have been introduced in Congress off and on since 1974, but none has succeeded. The most recent version passed late last year in the U.S. Senate, but it's going nowhere in the House. Most equality activists now consider it to be a highly flawed piece of legislation anyway, with religious exemptions, as a comic might say, that are big enough to drive a truck through.
And finally, we told you in April about Lotta, South Carolina's openly lesbian police chief Crystal Moore being fired by Mayor Ed Bullard for what phone recordings of Bullard with a town council member revealed to be a clear case of homophobia.
I'd much rather have, and I'll say this to anybody's face, I would much rather have somebody who drank too much taking care of my child than I had somebody whose lifestyle is questionable around children.
But as we noted a moment ago, there's no federal law and no law in South Carolina or 28 other states for that matter to protect a person from being fired just for being lesbian or gay. The town of about 1,400 people voted by a wide margin on June 24th to shift power away from Mayor Bullard and give the town council the power to reinstate Moore. But the vote still needed to be certified at the end of the week. Before that could happen, Mayor Bullard replaced the interim police chief with a permanent hire, a man from another local police department, who would also be making $8,000 a year more than what Moore was being paid after more than 20 years of service. Town Council member Jarrett Taylor told MSNBC's The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell on June 25th that the council intended to reinstate Moore as soon as the votes were certified. Moore herself also appeared on the program.
The citizens came out and they voted, they showed their support, they came to the polls in thunderstorms and rain, and we won 328 to 147. I felt like, okay, I've been hired back. I have my job back that I've worked hard for 23 years to have. I've done nothing wrong. And then 9:30 this morning, I come up to talk to the officers and find out the mayor has hired a new police chief. So it's like a nightmare that will not stop.
But Moore's story has a happy ending. The town council reinstated her and swore her in again as Lhasa police chief on June 27th.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 28th, 2014. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Extra.
Have you checked our website lately? For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
Coming up later in the program, a new movie refuses to dance around the AIDS crisis. But first...
Oh, come along with me to my little corner of the world. Dream a little dream in my little corner of the world.
The spirit of inclusion is sweeping much of mainstream Christianity, but the diehard dogma defenders still believe that godliness and LGBT liberation are mutually exclusive. Some even have apocalyptic delusions about the progress of LGBT civil rights. One such fantasy is being brought to the silver screen by the American Family Association and a company headed by former U.S. Senator and 2012 presidential candidate Rick Santorum.
Hi, and welcome back to Focal Point, American Family Radio Talk Network. Focal Point, the home of muscular Christianity on conservative talk radio. My name is Brian Fisher, congenial, convivial, and amiable as always. Honored and pleased to welcome to our decision-maker line Senator Rick Santorum, former senator from the state of Pennsylvania, former candidate for the presidency, and now the CEO of Echolight Productions, a film company. Senator Santorum, welcome to Focal Point with Brian Fisher.
Hey, Brian. Thank you for having me on.
Your studio, in conjunction with American Family Studios, getting ready to release a brand-new movie entitled One Generation Away, The Erosion of Religious Liberty.
It's probably the most important issue for the church today. There is a movement in this country to constrict religious liberty to freedom of worship, which is what you can do inside your church. And that once you walk outside the doors of the church, you become at the whim of the government to tell you what you can believe and what you can't believe. And that should frighten everybody. You see situations with bakers and florists and photographers who are now being forced to provide services for same-sex weddings, or get fined, lose their business. In the case of Colorado, there was a Colorado case just recently where someone had to go to re-education camp, if you will. And the amazing thing is, in Colorado, gay marriage isn't even legal. They have every intention of making people conform to their value structure, not the value structure of the church. If you watch this film, here's what you'll get. Here's what you'll know. They are fighting. They are fighting. They're not backing away. They are coming at us. We have to understand that this is a war, and if we don't engage in this war, we will lose this war.
Conservative Republican Rick Santorum and the American Family Association's Brian Fisher are gearing up for war. But there's good news coming from other corners of Christendom. Reverend Dr. Cameron Partridge delivered the first ever sermon by an openly transgender priest at the Episcopal-run National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. during the iconic venue's annual Pride celebration.
I'm moved by how our decisions are calling us into a deeper awareness of the mystery of the human person. For at the end of the day, to respect the dignity of every human being, as we promise in our baptismal covenant, is to actively create space for the unfolding of our lifelong growth as members of Christ's body, whoever we may be.
Reverend Dr. Cameron Partridge preaching at the National Cathedral on the church's evolving consciousness around sexual orientation and gender identity. In another breakthrough for evolution, Reverend Frank Schaefer of the United Methodist Church was reinstated by an appeals committee this week. Schaefer had been defrocked for officiating at his gay son's wedding. An elated Schaefer told MSNBC's The Last Word,
"I think this is a huge step in the right direction. I mean, look, I actually said in front of my trial court, in front of the church, in front of the whole world, really, that I would not refuse ministry to anybody based on their sexual orientation. And I went on record to say I would perform another gay marriage. I was defrocked based on that statement, but the church reconsidered and refrocked me today. And I think that is a wonderful message to our LGBTQ community within the church and beyond. The church is changing, and that is beautiful."
United Methodist Church Pastor Frank Schaefer will now take on the upbringing of a new generation of Christians as a youth minister in Santa Barbara, California. Traditionalist homophobes, beware.
So my brother says God is a flat-butted, crew-cutted linebacker, a macho babe hijacker, panting at the line of scrimmage. He makes God in his own image, and I don't begrudge him that. But his is a God who hates all fags, Jews, Hindus, and kids in rags. The Bible can thump like a big bass drum till every single sacred cow comes home. I know where that's at. God is wild. God is wide, God is wide. You can't get around to the other side. You can't outrun him and you sure can't hide. God is wide, God is wide, God is wide. Side. You can't outrun him and you sure can't hide. So my brother said.
On the go? Miss the show? This Way Out can offer you another way out. You can now hear the show on Stitcher, radio on demand. Check out the new Stitcher player at thiswayout.org and download the free app for your iPhone, Android, Nook, or iPad. Listen whenever and wherever, and give our voices a boost by rating and reviewing your favorite international LGBT radio show, This Way Out. Our entertainment correspondent says that a new movie set in San Francisco during the onerous 80s passes the Steve Pride test.
Chris Mason Johnson's feature film, Pest, is set in 1985 San Francisco and the world of modern dance. Touching, beautiful, and unexpected, it transports us back to a year that many in the gay community would rather forget. But of course, we mustn't ever forget, ever.
I've been feeling a little dizzy lately.
Dizzy?
Not dizzy exactly. More like I try to stabilize myself and I can't. Like I've lost my inner balance or something.
Headaches?
No.
Trouble with any kind of motor activity?
No. Just when I try to stand still, I can't stand still.
Here, we can do a test on your inner ear. But sometimes a virus can linger in there and affect your balance or cause a ringing sound.
A virus?
I'm Chris Mason Johnson. I'm the writer-director of Test. It takes place in San Francisco in 1985. A modern dance company is the setting. And the protagonist, Frankie, is a young dancer in a dance company. It's really contemporary ballet. And it's the early years of the AIDS epidemic before, I think it was even perceived as an epidemic, before there was a test. So the film focuses on these very, very young men who are afraid. So that's one of the plot lines, just dealing with this sort of ominous background noise of this thing that's looming. And the other is The Dance Story, which is a young male dancer's story, trying to make it, trying to fit in.
What inspired you to make this film?
Well, I was a dancer before I went to college and then became a filmmaker. So I was there, I was very young, and so a lot of it is autobiographical. And I felt that this story hadn't been told. We'd seen a lot of really wonderful, seminal films that dealt with AIDS, but I think it's safe to say all of them are deathbed films, if you will, about people getting sick and dying. Those stories needed to be told, obviously, and probably needed to be told first. But I think now there's a space has opened up to tell some other stories.
As someone who lived through the 80s, I have to say you nailed not just the look, but the feel of the era.
I was there in the 80s, and I hadn't seen my reality represented. There'd been the sort of wedding singer glitzy thing, and then there'd been the tragedies. But there hadn't been my story and my visual remembrance of that period. And some details like the checking your skin. In those early days, you didn't know if you had it basically until you were dying, because the sign was the Kaposi. And by the time you had that, you were dying. Suddenly, every freckle, every mole became paranoid. Yeah. So I wanted to represent that. And Walkman. I remember when suddenly the Walkman features very strongly in it. The before and after isn't the digital, like when we went from analog to digital. The before and after is when music was portable and music was everywhere and you could put music in your ears and walk down the street and score your life. So I wanted to use the cassette player and the Walkman. And that was also a cinematic decision. That is, I knew I wanted to make a movie with less dialogue than is conventional. And I wanted music, because it's a dance story, to be important not only in the choreography, but also in the character's life. It's a very internal movie, and it's about his state of mind and his POV, or point of view. So music worked for all of that, as well as cinematically. Music and film are kind of inseparable.
What was the biggest challenge in making a period film?
Well, I didn't want to do that thing you see a lot of in TV and indie films, if I can be a little critical here, that I don't like, which is let's go to the thrift store and buy all the clothes from the period and dress everybody up and you just do your internet research or do your whatever. And you say, oh, look, these are all the things that were there. I'll put them all in. And of course, that's not how life works. We might be wearing a shirt we bought 10 years ago. We might be listening to music that we heard in our childhood, not the releases that year. So there's a mix of periods in daily life, and often period films don't account for that. And they become very fake and very glib. We're doing the 80s, which can be fine for a comedy or for nostalgia, but this was a drama, so I wanted it to be subtler.
It's a film with two gay lead characters. It's a film about the HIV test. But the story is so much more than that. What do you hope audiences take away from the film?
One of the reviews, I think it was LA Weekly, said that it was deeply satisfying. And I think that's the feeling I want people to go away with. Deeply satisfying on an emotional level in terms of what happens in the story. I don't want to give away the ending or anything, but where the characters end up, it's not predictable. And people are telling me that they're continually surprised by the character development. I surprised myself writing it. I didn't do the usual three-act outline and I know where it's going to be and all that kind of paranoid Hollywood overthinking of structure. I actually wrote the whole thing and then I looked at it and I said, wait a minute, that's not what should happen at the end. I really discovered it. And I think that's the process the audience feels too. They discover where it goes and then it's the old chestnut, surprising but inevitable, and then it's satisfying. Another thing I would say I would want them to take away is that there were other aspects of that period and that story than what we've seen. In particular, these very young characters are so inarticulate, and they don't talk about what's happening. And I think that was a common experience for a lot of people. It wasn't the hyper-articulate response that you get in brilliant and amazing masterworks like Angels in America, where people are talking about it. It's a sort of a theatrical metaphor. They need to talk about it to get the issue out there. But there was, and this is why I tried to do a piece with little dialogue that was very cinematic, is that there were people who weren't talking about it. So how do you dramatize that without language? That was one of the challenges. So that's another thing I'd like people to take away, is the stories we've seen about that era are not the whole story. And I was really worried at a sort of vulnerable level about this, because a lot of this is autobiographical. And I was really afraid people wouldn't take this story seriously. I wasn't a hero. I wasn't a martyr. You know, I didn't spend long hours at hospice helping people. I didn't die. And there's a lot of survivor's guilt. So I was just one of the people who turned out okay. And I thought people might turn on that story, might be angry. So it was very deeply personally rewarding to see this film received and, Frankie, the character taken seriously. Like, this guy's experience matters. Because honestly, I didn't think my experience mattered. That's me. For young people, the response I've gotten, people 20-somethings and students I teach at Amherst College, where I'm a visiting lecturer in film, they are just like, thank you. I didn't know anything about that era. I had no idea. You know, for them, condoms have always been around for gays, you know. And older people who lived through it, obviously a strong identification and validation of that.
This has been a conversation with Chris Mason Johnson, writer-director of the film Test. Find more information at testthefilm.com. I'm Steve Fry. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michelle Marie Gookeson, Wenzel Jones, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Anita Bryant, Dave Hall, and Bronski Beat performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, and our generous listeners for making this program possible. Log on to thiswayout.org for program information, news wrap transcripts, social media links, and more. Don't forget, you can also hear the show on iTunes and now on Stitcher Radio on Demand. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KUMD, Duluth, Minnesota, Planet FM, Auckland, New Zealand, WSUI, Iowa City, Iowa, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station, Stay the Tuned.